Hearing Voices from NPR.
Here are the rules. Get caught, and you go back to Mexico. Make it across, and you get a job in the fields or the back rooms. Don't make it, and you die.
Crossing Borders, a tale of two countries.
Out in the Sonoran Desert, home of the saguaro cactus and Gila monster, 20 people are getting into the back of a pickup truck.
We take a trip to that imaginary line in our minds that divides two great nations.
Hong Kong, by the way, has been entirely relocated to Baja, 70 miles south of Tijuana. It is now called Baja Kong.
Crossing Borders, a Hearing Voices special.
All the vatos, arms around their sisters. All the vatos talking to their women. All the vatos granting their forgiveness. All the vatos plotting wicked paybacks.
Coming up, border stories by Luis Alberto Urrea, Scott Carrier, and Guillermo Gomez Peña.
From NPR, this is Hearing Voices.
Welcome to Crossing Borders, a Hearing Voices special, supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Marcos Martinez of KUNM Radio in Albuquerque. This is a St. Jude's festival in the highlands of Michoacán, Mexico. Sia Maxi Oshansi made the recording. The border between the U.S. and Mexico has the highest number of both legal and illegal crossings in the world. 1 million Mexicans a year or more enter the U.S. illegally. In the next hour, we'll hear what it's like to cross the hot, sometimes deadly desert of southern Arizona. People get lost. They run out of water. They must hide from La Migra, the border patrol, and be on the lookout for bandits who rob, even rape, and kill. Some make it, others don't. You'll hear both their stories. Before we make our first crossing, let's have a hymn from the book Vatos. A vato's a dude or a homeboy.
It's called Hymn to Vatos Who Will Never Appear in a Poem.
Poet Luis Alberto Urrea.
All the vatos sleeping in the hillsides. All the vatos say goodnight forever. All the vatos loving their menudo. All the vatos faith in la tortilla. All the vatos fearing the alarm clock. All the vatos wino, jefe, peewee. All the vatos, even the cabrones. All the vatos down por vida homeboys. All the vatos using words like ranfla. All the vatos who woke up abandoned. All the vatos not afraid of daughters. All the vatos arms around their sisters. All the vatos talking to their women. All the vatos granting their forgiveness. All the vatos plotting wicked paybacks. All the vatos with tequila visions. All the vatos they call maricones. All the vatos bleeding in the alleys. All the vatos chased by helicopters. All the vatos dissed by pinches white boys. All the vatos bent to pick tomatoes. All the vatos smoked by Agent Orange. All the vatos brave in deadly classrooms. All the vatos pacing in the prisons. All the vatos pierced by needle lightning. All the vatos who were once our fathers. All the vatos, even veteranos. All the vatos and their abuelitos. All the vatos proud of tatuajes. All the vatos carrying a lunch pail. All the vatos graduating law school. All the vatos grown up to be curas. All the vatos never been to misa. All the vatos Jimmy, Spider Tito. All the vatos lost their tongues in Spanish. All the vatos can't say shit in English. All the vatos looking at her photo. All the vatos faded clear as windows. All the vatos needing something better. All the vatos bold in strange horizons. All the vatos waiting for tomorrow. All the vatos sure that no one loves them. All the vatos sure that no one sees them. All the vatos sure that no one hears them. All the vatos never in a poem. All the vatos told they don't belong here. All the vatos beautiful young Aztecs. All the vatos warrior Apaches. All the vatos sons of Guadalupe. All the vatos bad as la chingada. All the vatos call themselves Chicanos. All the vatos praying for their children. All the vatos, even all you feos. All the vatos filled with life eternal. All the vatos sacred as the sun god. All the vatos flaco, Pepe, gordo. All the vatos rising from their mothers. All you vatos, you are not forgotten.
Out in the Sonoran Desert, home of the saguaro cactus and Gila monster, 20 people are getting into the back of a pickup truck. Mostly teenage boys, two women, the rest men. They're Mexicans, and we're in Mexico, 2 miles south of the border at Sasabe, Arizona. It's 10:30 in the morning, close to 100 degrees. In a few minutes, the truck will take them to the barbed wire fence on the border, and they'll begin walking north. My partner, photographer Julian Cardona, asked them what part of Mexico they come from.
¿Nos pueden decirnos los lugares de México donde vienen uno por uno?
Veracruz.
Oaxaca.
Veracruz.
Oaxaca.
DF.
Oaxaca.
Oaxaca.
¿Dónde?
Tabasco.
There's a Mexican border agent with us, Beta Group Officer Carlos Ozaya Moreno. He's got a uniform, he's got a badge, but his job is not to apprehend these people, it's to assist them in their journey. He says, are you guys prepared? You have water, food? You realize you're going to have to walk for a long time, maybe for hours, maybe for days. You're going to have to walk at night. He tells the group if they get into trouble to contact his office. Beta Group can help. The men and boys nod, but in a few minutes they're going to be in the United States, and in a few hours it'll be 115 degrees in the shade. And what can Beta Group do for them then?
So, can we see what you have, what you're going to carry with you?
Water.
Sardine, water.
Suero.
Suero is water mixed with electrolytes.
Limones, sal,
ajo,
garlic.
Garlic.
Maybe you would. We don't know.
One more question. Are you worried they might die?
No.
Life is that way.
Gracias.
Officer Zosiah gives us a ride back into Sasabe. And I tell him I'm confused about his job.
You don't try to stop them from going across?
No.
He says no. According to Mexican law, every citizen has the right to leave the country. So Beta Group helps them if they get sick, and they count the numbers of people leaving. He says in the winter, about 3,000 people come through the Sasabe area every day. Now, in June, because of the heat, it's down to 1,000 a day. He calls the migrants pollos, or chickens. What's not legal, he says, is to be a coyote, someone who smuggles chickens across the border for money.
So was there a guide, a coyote, with them?
I ask him if there was a coyote with a group in the back of the pickup truck.
Seguramente.
And he says, for sure. They had a coyote, and they were each paying between $1,000 and $2,000 for his service. I do the math. If there's between 1,000 and 3,000 people moving through the Sasabe area every day, that's about 500,000 people a year. And if each pays $1,000 for a coyote, that's $500 million, a travel industry unto itself. Only sometimes the pollos don't make it. They get caught by U.S. Border Patrol, they get robbed by bandits, or they get separated from the group and the coyotes leave them behind. They get lost, they die. Sometimes their bodies are never found. You can see some of the money in Sasabe, Sonora, just across from Sasabe, Arizona. You don't see it in the homes and businesses, as these are adobe hovels. The town is the kind of place you wouldn't really want to get out of your car. Dirt roads, the natives a tad hostile, but there is an unusual presence of new pickup trucks, with a preference for the Ford F-150 Lobo, $30,000, and sometimes they're driven by young boys, barely tall enough to reach the gas pedal and see over the dashboard.
So that guy?
He looks like about 13.
12 or 13.
Julian has photos of a 9-year-old driving his new Lobo to school.
That's the truck you were talking about.
No, no, no.
This is a different one?
Different one. And they are the owners. Believe me.
We spend the afternoon walking around, looking at the motels and crash pads where the migrants hole up during the heat of the day. We try to talk to some people inside an adobe bunkhouse, but a young man stops us out front and asks us to leave because he's worried about being seen talking to us. People get killed around here for less, he says. About 5:30 in the afternoon, the people start coming out on the street. Men, women, and children in groups, each with a small backpack, carrying a 1 gallon jug of water or suero. Julian and I follow a group of 27 that includes kids about 4 or 5 years old and 2 babies. They walk north toward the border, and when they're about 200 yards from the U.S. Customs House, they turn right off the road and head up a rocky hillside. One man says his name is Jesus from Mexico City. He's trying to get to Houston. He says he's made this trip before, and one time he was robbed. He says, you just have to look out for yourself out here. There's no other alternative. He says, this is not our fault. The fault lies with our government. They help only the rich. They steal a lot. Us poor people, they treat us very badly. We're hungry. We have to struggle for what we get in life. The group stops on the far side of the hill, out of sight of the U.S. Customs office. Julian is taking photos of the people, and one man, probably the coyote, is waving his arms, telling them to stop. Nobody makes a sound except the babies. The view looking north is of a desert floor stretching 10 miles to a range of mountains. It could be the Serengeti, but it's southern Arizona, a part known as the Buenos Aires National Wildlife Refuge. Nobody out there but bandits and U.S. Border Patrol. These people are going to walk across this desert in the dark. It's 60 miles to Tucson. Maybe their coyote has a pickup truck waiting somewhere, and they won't have to walk the whole distance. Or maybe they'll be arrested and sent back, or maybe they'll get separated and lost. I can't help thinking, what about the babies, the little kids? It seems like a big mistake, but they're going to do it. They get up and start walking north toward the wildlife refuge. I watch them go, wondering what it is they come from to make this worth the risk.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
No, 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 no. Yo juro alianza a la bandera de los Estados Unidos de América. Carajo. No, caramba, la república que esta representa. Ay, Dios. Una nación de barrios divididos. Oh, por favor. Sin libertad y justicia para nadie.
That was Citizenship Lesson by Guillermo Gómez Peña from his collection Borderless Radio. Guillermo's poetry and especially his performance art express the spicy, steamy, intertextual stew of the border region. At his website, bochanostra.com, he describes his work as performance activism and oppositional art. Before Guillermo's piece was our journalist friend Scott Carrier in Sasabe, Sonora, Mexico. In a minute, we'll hear Scott reporting from Sasabe, Arizona, but first, evening mass at the Church of Carmen Alta in Oaxaca City. It's recorded by Bronwyn Zim of the 1 Minute Vacation podcast at quietamerican.org.
Buenos Aires National Wildlife Refuge is a big chunk of land, 118,000 acres. It used to be a cattle ranch, but is now managed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as a home to 325 species of birds, 53 reptiles and amphibians, 58 mammals, and the endangered Pima pineapple cactus. At the visitor center, I pick up a tip sheet called Safety Precautions. It says, "What makes the Buenos Aires National Wildlife Refuge so attractive are the grasslands, open spaces, wildlife, and water. These same attributes make the refuge an ideal point for illegal entry into the United States. You should avoid contact with these groups or individuals. If you're approached for food or water, you should leave the area and contact refuge personnel or Border Patrol, who will assist them. Do not put yourself at risk by giving aid. In Yellowstone, it's dangerous to feed the bears. Here, it's dangerous to feed the illegal aliens."
Hi, this is Fish and Wildlife 482.
Sylvester Martinsik is a security officer for the refuge.
1010 code 103.
He's a young man, 6'4", and has big hands that are shaking due to the fact he's been working most of the past 48 hours.
Excellent. And I'll be 10-1 radio right now.
He lives on the refuge, says there are aliens going by his house day and night.
Thanks.
I ask him to tell me about it, and he starts reading from his log 2 days before.
Well, I started out my day with exercise, and then I apprehended two groups of aliens at my house. And then one of the groups, the second group, I always ask him if there's more people in the group, you know, what their condition is, etc. And they told me that there were several more. Actually, they crossed the border with 27, I think, or 28 people. 28 people. And then they'd already left seven behind. And they'd already been walking about 4 days. And they claimed to have been out of food and water for 3 days. And they left a woman and kids behind. They didn't know where they left them. They just left them. Often what they do is they'll all go take a nap, and then they'll wake up the ones that are strong, and then they'll just leave the other ones that are weak.
There's no way to be sure, but the group he's describing sounds like the group Julian and I saw leaving Sasebe. The timing is right, the number of people is right, and there were two babies.
We went out and looked for them, and these people, they're completely nude in the dirt, covered with dirt, rolling around, dirt in their mouth. They look like Aborigines. I mean, they look sad. They were sitting there groveling in the dirt like my dog would when he can't find shade, you know. And that's what they're doing, you know. And it was a really sad sight to see. There was in one spot, you know, in their eyelids, they had dirt. But they opened their mouth, they had dirt in their mouth. And that's normally what they do, you know, right before they die. So they're pretty bad off. And the one guy was dry heaving over there. They told me that they couldn't walk anymore. They couldn't walk back to my house from where they'd seen my house, and it was a couple miles. And so...
At a certain point in the conversation, Sylvester starts feeling uncomfortable and asks me to turn off the tape recorder. He says he hasn't had enough sleep, and he's worried he's not making any sense and may say something he shouldn't, for his job, for reasons he's not even sure about. He just doesn't want to talk anymore. I say, okay, fine. But what happened to the people he found in the desert? And he says he called the Border Patrol, and they came and got them. Then he says, maybe I should talk to his wife, Lisa. She's at home, making dinner. Maybe I should come to dinner. The Martinsiks, Sylvester, Lisa, their five kids and two dogs, live in a ranch house, 20 miles from the nearest neighbor, 25 miles north of the border. They're devout Christians, the bookshelves full of religious books. They're homeschooling their kids. The oldest is 8, the youngest is almost 1. Sly's away a lot, working both day and night, so Lisa's there alone with the kids, and the ranch house, to someone who's walked 25 miles from the border, is a place with water and food and a phone. When they come to the house, it's because they can't go any farther. They come to give up.
So you have migrant illegal aliens coming through here a lot?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a lot. Just the other day we had three of them on Sunday morning stop by. And then the other night we had 35 or 40 come in front of our house. So there's quite a bit.
What time at night?
That was 11 o'clock, but sometimes you'll hear, we'll have our windows open, we can hear cars driving by through here all hours of the night. So when our dogs start barking in a certain way, we can tell, and we look out the windows, and usually there's aliens, and the kids have to, I try to have them not show themselves, not make any noise.
Do they come right up to your house?
Shortly after we moved here, there was an older man who hopped the fence and came up to, I think they came up the back, and then he came around and came through. There's a door over there, and he sat on our porch, and then he kept using his walking stick to pound on our door. And that was really unnerving. And for one thing, many of them are criminals, and they have records. So that's a bad thing in and of itself. So if we've got terrorists coming across, there's no way to stop them, really. If they want to be across, they can come across. It's not a problem. And I don't know how far all that extends, but... Paul, please stop. Okay?
Are you worried about your kids being out here?
At times, I am. I believe in God. I believe He's there with me, and whatever He will allow to happen to me is in His design and in His plan, and I can rest in that. I can sleep at night. You know, I'm not really brave in and of myself, but I can be confident in Him. So that's how I see it.
I leave Sly and Lisa's house at sunset, drive along a dirt road, back to the highway that goes north to Tucson. The desert at this hour does not look or feel hostile. The sun is safely beyond the horizon, and the grass and trees seem to be glowing from exuberance at having made it through another day. In the hour or so before dark, this is not a place where women and kids are wandering lost, not a place where naked men swim through the dirt. This is when men and boys from Oaxaca and Veracruz sit in the grass and eat lemons and garlic, when babies stop crying and fall asleep in their mother's arms. For an hour or so, Sly and Lisa can relax, put their own kids to bed, and watch the sky change from orange to red to blue to black.
Producer Scott Carrier. Coming up, we'll take another trip to that imaginary line in our minds that divides two great nations. That's in a minute when we return with Crossing Borders from HearingVoices.com, supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts.
From NPR, this is Hearing Voices.
Welcome back to Border Crossings. I'm Marcos Martinez of KUNM Radio in Albuquerque. You know, some Chicanos in the Southwest like to say that we didn't cross the border crossed us. You see, the American Southwest used to be part of Mexico, and the flow of people and goods from north to south and back again is a historical tide that's hard to stem. Next are some lucky ones who survived the dangerous desert journey. This story comes from Chicago's Third Coast Festival. The producers are Ann Hepperman and Kara Oler. It's called And I Walked.
They play a game here, but nobody watches from a box seat. The players are called wets by those who hunt them. They cross a hot desert, a dry desert, and they cross with 1 or 2 gallons of water. They walk 30, 40, 50, 60 miles in order to score. The goal line here means not 6 points, but a job. Here are the rules. Get caught, and you go back to Mexico. Make it across, and you get a job in the fields or the back rooms. Don't make it, and you die.
Crucé la semana pasada.
Sí, caminé 3 días.
3 noches caminando. Íbamos 4 personas.
Solo, caminando por el desierto.
I walk all day on the sun. By the end of the day, I only had 1 gallon of water. I started with 2 gallons.
Un traguito nomás sin mojarse los labios nomás.
In the morning, started walking again. Walk all day, and then still walked part of the night.
Agents found the body of a man believed to be an illegal immigrant hanging from a tree in the desert.
The deaths bring the total number of deaths by crossers in Arizona to 106 for this year. Authorities say
people have died trying to cross the Mexican border into Arizona.
There are no springs or streams, and no one lives here. No one. But still they keep coming. Day after day, night after night. Some will move only during daylight because they fear snakes. Some refuse to wear hats. And I cannot help but wonder what kind of experiences produce people willing to take on such ground.
It's a sign of desperation.
They pay better in the U.S. than here. I've just arrived from work, and I start at 7 in the morning, and then I finish at 6. And they paid me $6 for the whole day.
If they could live this fairly good life at their places, I'm pretty sure they wouldn't be here.
With heat and thirst, the body temperature soars, and the brain seems to cook. The flesh feels electric with pain, as each cell screams out its complaint. People in such circumstances tear off their clothes in the hope of being cooled. Sometimes the border patrol finds corpses with the mouth stuffed with sand.
Bravo 14, Bravo 1. One incident that I came upon was my eye caught this one bush, and I noticed there's some legs. There was someone lying down underneath a bush. And I thought whoever it was deceased, but when I got up on her, it was a female. She was lying down on her stomach, ready to die.
You start blistering. A lot of blisters on your mouth, around your lips. Start hallucinating and you start thinking, oh, I'm gonna die. But you can't think clearly because It's not you anymore. You start thinking about death. You start thinking if you're going to heaven or if you're going to hell, or like if you're going to die in the desert and then you're not going to be found by anybody and you're going to be eaten by animals.
The coyotes wanted to eat me. There are a lot of coyotes. The animals wanted to eat me. There were 5 and I was staying still and quiet. And they were approaching me, so I put my bottles around me to scare them off. And I had a lighter that I used to fend them off. And I was by myself. The animals were waiting for me to die.
You don't even think. You don't have no brain to think about anything.
Coyotes. A lot of coyotes.
people is going to the United States hoping to find a job and send money to their families back home, and what they find is death. They never make it over there, and they never make it back home.
The Desert Tonight is an enormous theater full of tracks made by men and women and sometimes children, all inching north. They play a game here. We play a game here.
It was July 14th. I was sitting in a rowdy Tijuana cafe, drinking Kahlua with milk and thinking about the French Revolution. That day, 200 years ago, for the first time, Western society exercised its will to imagine other possibilities for the future. And strangely, we are the product of that future. I came across an interesting ad.
Using global production sharing to make money means being in the right place at the right time. And for a growing number of international companies, now is the time to move operations to San Diego, California, and Tijuana, Mexico. Find out how our unique Maquiladora twin plant program can help make your business more competitive.
I suddenly began to daydream. It's the year 2000 on the U.S.-Mexico border, and a new multinational government has been created. Instead of a president, there is a kind of corporate junta composed by a binational group of technocrats and businessmen from Mexico, the U.S., Taiwan, Japan, Germany, and Hong Kong. Hong Kong, by the way, has been entirely relocated to Baja, 70 miles south of Tijuana. It is now called Baja Kong. San Diego and Tijuana have merged into San Diejuana, the capital of Border Incorporated. Throughout the entire 2,000 miles of borderline, there are Maquiladora twin plants daily producing an assortment of useful and useless products, such as microcomputer chips, multi-purpose transistors, nostalgic heavy metal t-shirts, robotic toys, and home entertainment units that include an audio system, a mini fridge, a microwave, and a video telephone.
Esta es la voz del futuro binacional. Esta es la voz.
These maquiladoras have names like Sony Funken and Macintosh Rodriguez and Associates. Resembling stark techno convents, these buildings literally stand on the border between two countries. Each has two entrances, one from the U.S. and one from Mexico. The top executives and the administrative personnel enter from the U.S. and the assembly workers, who are 89% women, enter from the Mexican side. The executives can cross into the assembling space without documents, yet the workers have to remain on the Mexican side. The governments of the two neighboring countries are reacting quite differently to the existence of Border Incorporated. Washington officials like the idea very much, but they are obviously nervous about their limited partnership with their multiracial colleagues. The Mexican government is going bananas. I woke up sweating. I was the last one in the cafe. I realized that I had drank too much. I paid my bill and began to walk toward the border checkpoint. On my way, I realized I had forgotten my wallet in the cafe. with my precious resident alien card. Damn it. I won't be able to cross the border, I thought. So I decided to continue celebrating the anniversary of the French Revolution in the tropical bars of East Tijuana.
Guillermo Gomez Peña, imagining maquiladoras of the future. And this is Luis Alberto Urrea reading to an audience in Santa Fe from his book, The Devil's Highway.
There was a boy from Guadalajara named Jesus Lopez Ramos who had come to Nogales, Sonora, across from Arizona, to work in a brickyard, and he got recruited to be a coyote. The lowest rung of the coyote world now is the guías, the guides, and he was hired as a guide. And he was leading these fellows into the United States. There's a pass they get to called Bluebird Pass, where they can turn out of the mountains and head straight into Ajo, Arizona. When they got to Bluebird Pass, somebody illuminated them with spotlights, and they ran. And they went one small mountain range over. So when they resumed their walk north, the next pass wasn't there. And the final pass wasn't there. The leader, Jesus, trying to keep control of this group, most of whom were older than he was, started to panic. And they were in the dark. They didn't have any orienteering skills, no maps, just what he knew to walk. So he started trying to make up the path as he went. One thing that the sign cutters in the Border Patrol taught me about tracking is that if you go a certain direction as you walk, you tend to repeat that direction always. In other words, if you meet a barrier and you turn to the left, you will continue turning to the left around every barrier, small or large. He kept turning to the left, and his path kept veering until he ended up going dead south again and walked them almost all the way back to the border. When the sun came up, they realized they were in serious trouble because it came up on the wrong side of their faces. They tried to walk again when a heat wave hit them, and they had lost all their water, and they slowly died. At some point, Jesus Lopez Ramos did what many of our young enterprising coyotes do, which is collected everybody's money and said, "I'm going to go get help for you. Just wait here." And he left, and he never went back. He says, "No, really, I really wanted to save them." No one knows. He went into a coma, never made it either to Interstate 8 or to their water. And as he was lying unconscious, these men began to die. The book is dedicated to the dead. And I just wanted to say before I read this that I believe that they are here with you. Rudy Anaya once told me that writing is a ritual through which spirits find their way home. So if you feel a breeze or hear a whisper, they're here because they've been lied about and they've been disrespected and forgotten. So I wanted to read to you about them. They walked. They walked. They walked. There was no other story. They walked. They said cholla cactus looked like trees covered in spike balls. The group started to break apart as the demons and angels started to sing to them. They could smell their own stench. It was embarrassing. It was frightening. Naum Landa Ortiz. We kept walking. We were walking all day in that f***ing desert, going under little trees. That's where they started dying, you know, when they got under the trees. Men stumbled away toward illusions in the brutal light. Men thought they were home, walking in their front doors, hugging their wives, making love. Still, they walked. Men were swimming. Men were killing the coyote. Men were on the beach, collecting shells and watching their children splash. And they walked. A voice was heard in the light shatter, saying, "He's going to die. Lay him down here. Keep walking." The desert, out of focus and suddenly terribly sharp, burst white and yellow in their eyes. It tilted, elongated. It was at an impossible angle. It tipped up toward the sun, and if they didn't crawl, they would slide right off the earth forever. It made noise. There were engines beneath the desert. It made evil grinding noises, mechanical humming. No, it was insectile, the screech of hunger and derision. The devils were under the rocks, spitting insults. "I believe in God the Father, creator of heaven and earth." No, it did not laugh. It was silent as a graveyard. Just the crunch and slide, crunch and slide. Endless, hopeless footsteps, hundreds of footsteps. Crunch, slide, gasping. That was the sound. Gasping, sobbing, heartbeats. Canta y no llores. The ragged breathing of those walking beside them made the men cringe, stop to piss. Piss in your hands. Lick every hot drop from your fingers. If you're not trying to save yourself, piss in someone else's mouth. Sacrament. Communion. O God, in thy dwelling place, hear our pleas. Hearts drumming, soft hammers inside them, dull, fuzzy banging faster and faster. Blessed Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now. Wings above them, blue men, white teeth, nothing, empty bones, empty heat, nothing but sun, empty, nothing. By 2 o'clock, it was 108 degrees. They walked. Naum Landa Ortiz. I didn't watch the first one die. Two died apart from me. They were behind. I didn't see them die. Francisco Morales said, we started throwing things away. We were going to die. We threw away things in our pockets out of despair. Edgar Martinez, who didn't have a phone at home, who had to be reached, if anyone called, through a phone book in Cuautepec. His middle name, Adrian, nephew of Jose Isidro Colorado, in love with Claudia Reyes, son of Eugenio, stumbled. He righted himself and put out a hand and fell into a bush. He got to his knees, grimaced as if smiling. Perhaps he was ashamed to be falling. He was 16 years old. He fell again. He closed his eyes. He didn't rise. He lay there for the length of the next day, lost in a delirium no one can ever imagine, burning and burning. Not a mile from Edgar, Abraham Morales tripped and hit the ground. He crawled, rolled on his side, and kicked. His eyes were red. Nobody seemed to know him, for when they finally came and collected his body, he would lie unclaimed and unidentified for a month, alone in an icy drawer. Francisco Morales, I do not know who was dying or how many, because I too was dying. Jose de Jesus Rodriguez, that day, 3 in the afternoon, I was dead. What time is it right now? It's 4 o'clock? Yep, I died. I was dead from 3 o'clock to 4 o'clock. Then I came back from the dead at 11 o'clock. When we got sick, Jose Bautista said, there was no shade, so I crawled up to hide in the rocks. One of the boys went crazy and started jumping up and down. He started screaming, Mama, Mama, I don't want to die. He ran up to a big cactus and started smashing his face against it. I don't know what his name was. A voice carried on the still air crying, Madre, sálvame. The tracks of the dead could be haunting. One of the men tore off his shirt and tried to bury himself. The sign he left around him showed violent kicking, arm flailing as if he were swimming. He managed to get the top half of his torso buried in the ground where he either smothered or passed out. The relentless heat baked him, literally cooked him in the ground. His face bloated and came loose from his bones, tender as barbecued pork. Raimundo Vareda Jr. collapsed in his father's arms. He was 15 years old. Raimundo Sr. held him as he died, shook him, cried over him. He called for help, but the only thing that might have helped his son was water. When Raimundo died and slid out of his father's arms, his father lurched away into the desert, away from the trees, crying out in despair. Some of the men said he took American money he had saved for the trip and tore it into small bits. Julian Ambrose Malaga was also said to have torn up his money. His brother-in-law, Rafael Temich, after being prodded by Julian to walk on and save himself, was helpless to save him. That's when he took out the money and started tearing it apart, and he ran off alone, and I was demented. I couldn't help him. I couldn't carry him. Then he threw himself into the light, and he stayed there. Nobody knows the name of the man who took off all his clothes. It was madness, surely. He removed his slacks, folded them, and put them on the ground. Then he took off his underwear, laid it neatly on the pants. He removed his shirt and his undershirt and squared them away with the pants as if he didn't want to leave a mess. His shoes had the socks tucked inside them, and they were placed on his clothes to keep them from blowing away. He lay on his back and stared into the sun until he died. When the Border Patrol agents found him, one of them said, "This poor guy just crossed his ankles and died." Naum Landa's testimony reads like poetry. "We were in the trees, trying to hide from the sun, and they would yell to me, 'There's a guy dead over here,' and 'There's a guy dead over here.' There must have been 30 of us out there. There must have been 20 of us dead. By Monday, we were all dead. I was hiding under that tree. Out there, I saw people in despair. I saw them without water. I don't know why I survived. Maybe it's a miracle. Some of them just died of desperation. Some of them went insane. Some of them lost their minds. You could hear them screaming. Some fell all alone. I heard one guy screaming, 'Daring the pinche migra, come and get me.' Stupid things like that. He was desperate. He started singing. We were drinking urine. We were ripping open cactus." The dead bodies, dense and dark, were zipped into bags and delivered to the loading docks. They were shipped to Tucson because in Tucson, the medical examiners had their labs. The Mexican consul joined them. 14 dead men on the long drive through the desert. They took up a lot of room. They weighed a lot. They could be set on vertical racks like big loaves of bread since they were dead. Still, it took more than one vehicle to move them. What a lot of bother. This kind of fuss didn't sit well with working men from Veracruz. They didn't like handouts from anybody, and they would have walked to Tucson and back to the border if they could have. This flashing of lights, this slamming of doors, driving in convoys, it was unseemly. The vehicles were cool, especially after the terrible days in the sun. The ride was smooth, speedy. The procession of vehicles sped out of Yuma, headed east, out through the mountains and down through the Mohawk Valley. They passed under the silent Welton Migra station. Distant Migra helicopters and small planes flew search patterns like small black birds. It was relaxed. They got to lie on their backs the whole way. No sun hit them. The insides of the bags were fairly pleasant since there were no major bloody wounds to make them slick or sticky. The smell was already nasty, but the heavy rubber kept it from escaping and being humiliating. You see, Mexicans can't bear to be embarrassed by smells that may emanate from their bodies. These men had been impeccable in their grooming, as humble men from the interior almost always are. They went through the small barrier of the ABC Mountains and they skirted the northern edge of the Barry Goldwater bombing range. They went along Interstate 8 as if in a dream, one of those strange flying dreams, silent and cold. They skirted the north end of the Granite Mountains where they died. The cost of using vehicles, drivers, crews, gasoline was more than they would have earned in a month. But there was no worry now, just rest. Down into Tucson, down the ramp into the coroner's building, down the cement walkways, into cold rooms. Raimundo Barreda Sr. would likely have preferred to have been in the same bag as his boy, but they were kept apart. Raimundo Jr. was lost, alone and small, inside the bag. He was almost swimming in all that black rubber, sliding around as they drove and then lying on the icy metal table. They could have torn the rubber and held hands, I suppose, but they were resigned to their fate. Heriberto Baldillo's cactus punctures didn't hurt. Lorenzo Ortiz Hernandez wore brown pants. Reino Bartolo wore green socks to match his green pants. Mario Fernandez Castillo had his favorite silver rooster belt buckle. Enrique Landero's teeth were broken, but they no longer hurt him. Julian Malaga Ambro still had his colored piece of paper in a pocket that nobody would ever read. Claudio Alejandro Marin had a small mirror in his pocket, and if he could have, he would have checked his hair one last time. Arnulfo Badia had a letter in his pocket. He had carried it through the entire ordeal, now unread forever. They had had to call the phone booth in Cuautepec and hope somebody who knew Edgar Martinez would answer. Abraham Morales took the long truck drive with no name. He would lie in a drawer for a month waiting for somebody to recognize him. Efraín Manzano loved a girl named Maria, and her name was inked into the skin on his arm. And Laudo rode forlorn and anonymous, forever lost. No one would ever figure out his name, and after a futile search for next of kin, he would go into the soil of the potter's field in Tucson, nameless, there to lie, forgotten. They were close after what they'd been through. For a brief time, they were all together. It was a silent reunion. They lay in a row, almost touching. The dead men were loose now. Their feet bobbled when the carts bumped into each other as they were lined up, like they were tapping their feet or waking up. Most of their eyes were open. Small sounds escaped from a couple of the bodies as gases moved through them, almost sighs rustling in the bags. If you listened, you could hear them whispering, "We're going home."
Luis Alberto Urrea from his book, The Devil's Highway. The music was by Mexican composers Jorge Reyes and Tito La Riva. The 1 Minute Vacation field recordings you heard come from quietamerican.org. There's links to works by all the storytellers in this hour at hearingvoices.com. I'm Marcos Martinez of KUNM Radio in Albuquerque. Hearing Voices specials are supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of soundimagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding.
From NPR, National Public Radio, this is hearingvoices.com.